got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken thing. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Biotech Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your host, Cameron English. Last time we talked about how artificial womb technology is going to upend our political debates about abortion and child welfare. Today we're talking about a technology that will almost certainly be even more controversial. In the coming decades, parents will be able to have children that are immune to deadly diseases and maybe even smarter and physically stronger thanks to in vitro fertilization and embryo selection. Now, this is a huge scientific advancement, but it could also mean that humans no longer reproduce sexually. And that invites all kinds of awkward ethical questions. For example, could governments use this technology to breed super soldiers? And what about the possibility of a designer baby industry that commodifies human life? These are important questions, and my guest today is here to help us sort through them. Jamie Metzl is a technology futurist, a geopolitical expert, a novelist, and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He's also the author of a new book called Hacking Darwin, which takes a detailed look at this technology. Jamie, thanks for joining me today. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Doing very well. So tell me about the title of your book. What does Hacking Darwin mean?
Sure. Well, for 3.8 billion years, we have been evolving from single-cell organisms until the Homo sapiens who we are today by a set of rules. And those are the rules that Darwin largely identified of random mutation and natural selection. And now, for the first time in our history as a species, in the history of life as we know it, we are developing the capabilities to manage our own evolutionary process. So mutation will be directed and selection will be directed and directed by us. So we are hacking the very principles, or we will be hacking the very principles of Darwinian evolution that got us here. To put it another way, evolution itself is evolving, but evolving by a different set of rules.
I think you summed this up nicely in the introduction to the book. You say that we're moving into a future where more of us will reproduce in the lab than in our beds or in the backs of our cars. Now, I'm sure people are already painting a picture of what that looks like in their mind's eye, but what exactly are you getting at when you say something like that?
So human beings are biologically designed to reproduce sexually, and that's what our hormones are all about. It's one of our key drivers as a species. And frankly, sexual reproduction has been an enormous evolutionary advantage for us. So we're not getting rid of, no one's going to get rid of sexual reproduction, but we are increasingly going to step away from conception through the physical act of sex. And that scares people. People say, wait a second, sex is so great. So I'm not saying we're not going to have sex. We are going to have sex for the same reason that we have sex most of the time now, which is not for procreation, but for pair bonding and happiness and joy and all those other reasons. But increasingly, we are going to have sex we're going to conceive of our children through IVF and embryo screening. And the reason we're going to do that is in the near term, we are going to be able to screen pre-implanted embryos to reduce the risk of genetic disease. And the nearest term case will be eliminating, in many cases, single gene mutation disorders and diseases, some of which can be extremely dangerous and deadly. And about 3% of all children born have some kind of dangerous genetic abnormality. So we won't be able to eliminate all of those dangers, but in a relatively short period of time, through conceiving through IVF and embryo selection, we're going to be able to reduce those risks significantly. And so that's going to create a real incentive for parents who want to protect their children from these kinds of diseases to doing so. Another way of doing it without selecting pre-implanted embryos would be for people to get pregnant, to do non-invasive prenatal testing. But that's an excruciating choice for parents where the mother is already pregnant, to decide whether or not to abort because a genetic abnormality is identified. So it would be much more comfortable for people to screen out terrible diseases before a selection is made about which embryo to implant. And but once we go down that path, and as we learn more and more about what our genome is and does and means, then we're going to be able to make more predictions, and it won't be a one-to-one correlation like it is for some of these single gene mutation diseases and traits, but some increasingly informed predictions about the future health status of these pre-implanted embryos. And so we may know that one of the embryos being considered for implantation in the mother has a significantly elevated risk of getting, for example, early onset Alzheimer's or some other terrible genetic or partly genetic disease. And when we start to understand those complex traits, we will also begin to understand the genetics of other traits that have nothing to do or little to do with our sense of health, like height, like IQ, like personality style. And so we're going to get more and more information that will be available to us in the process of making babies. And I think a certain subset of us, maybe in certain parts of the world, are going to want to use that information in making selections about which of their unimplanted embryos to implant and to take the term. And for that reason, we're going to see a shift away from procreation through sex toward procreation using these types of assisted reproductive technologies.
You mentioned a lecture you were giving in the book to some millennial age folks like me, and you described the look on their faces as it kind of hit them what this technology means as it moves forward. I'm wondering if you can describe that story, because I think it sets up the rest of the book really well. And then, if you don't mind, explain how you feel about this technology, because as I was reading the book, I got the perception that you think it's exciting, but you're also sort of ambivalent about it. So clue us in. Am I on the right track there?
It's a tough decision because for we as a species, we are very familiar with sexual reproduction by sex. And we talk about doing it in other ways. For everybody, myself included, there's a thing, we know that there is this quote-unquote natural process with its strengths and also its dangers. And there's this very new science-driven process that conceptually we can understand the benefits, but nobody wants to be the first mover when it's their children's health that is at stake. And we have all kinds of experience where people do certain things because they think it'll be great for their kids, but it turns out that it's actually dangerous. And the inverse of that is also true. And so I certainly, whenever I speak to all kinds of groups, I always say that if you are thinking of having a child at some point in the future, if you are a guy, you probably should freeze your sperm. If you're a woman, you probably should freeze your eggs. I really believe that because we are only moving in a direction where the benefits of assisted reproduction will increase relative to sexual reproduction. And why not keep your options open? So I say that to a lot of different groups. And then once in a while, I get asked the question, well, would you do it? And it's tough because one, I'm not a lone actor. So, my girlfriend and I have talked about this, but if there's a choice of having a child, if we have a child through IVF and embryo screening versus sex. And it's hard. It's a two-person choice. I personally, though, like the idea of having more information rather than less, not just here, but in every aspect of my life. I mean, I am certainly a quantified self person. I've done my whole genome sequencing and multiple genome sequencing. I've done just for the heck of it, full body MRIs, you know, if I could have monitors and sensors giving me information constantly, I would love to have that. And not everybody lives that way. And so if I could reduce the risk of terrible genetic diseases among my progeny, and especially I'm an Ashkenazi Jewish person, and so we have a higher genetic risk than many other groups, it seems to me like a good thing to do. And it's going to get a lot more complicated, though, because I think most people would agree that selecting out terrible diseases makes sense. But relatively quickly, we're going to move from thinking about assisted reproduction as a way of reducing risk of bad things to a way of embracing things that we feel are good. Whether they're good or not is another question. And so, you know, that shift is happening. I'm, you know, pretty comfortable with it, but I'm on the far end of people who are comfortable living this way, and I know that most people aren't.
And the reason I ask that is because you parallel the development of this embryo selection technology with vaccination, and you actually say at one point that we may begin to judge parents who decide to reproduce sexually instead of reproducing in the lab. And so I get why that scares a lot of people when we're dealing with something that's so new and not untested, but it's still really, you know, we're still learning about it. So can you explain your thinking? Because, I mean, I get why that would worry people. And personally, it worries me a little bit, too.
Well, right now, there is a measles outbreak in the United States. And the reason we're having this measles outbreak is that enough parents have decided not to immunize their children. And that has created this risk for society that society in many ways is paying for. So you could say, and you would be right, if you said that if someone were to say, is it more natural to immunize your children or not immunize your children? I think everybody would say, well, it's more natural to not immunize your children. It totally makes sense. But is it good to not immunize your children? Most people, and not everybody, most people say, well, no, it's not good because you are taking a risk, not just for your children, but for society at large. And so for many people, if they hear, oh, so-and-so, their kid got measles, but they weren't vaccinated, they don't think, oh, it's a terrible, quote-unquote, act of God that this child got measles. They think, well, God, that's many people think, that's just irresponsible parenting. Why, if they could have reduced this significant risk, why wouldn't they? And they think, all right, so now these children need to suffer as a result of an ideological lifestyle choice by the parents. And so if you take that same structure and you move it to the issues related to assisted reproduction, and you see somebody who is born with a disease that's been eradicated, and the reason that child is born is because the parent made an ideological decision to accept a very significant risk of that disease, will you say, oh, that's just nature taking its course? Or will some or many people say, geez, that kid really has to suffer because the parents imposed their ideology on their child.
So to get behind the concern that a lot of people are going to have about this, you point out that when people are confronted with scientific innovations, they're just uncomfortable with it because they don't understand how it works yet. And the only way they could verbalize that concern is to say it's quote unquote unnatural. And I think you do a good job of covering this in the book. Would you go into that a little bit?
Exactly. So we are humans. We like to have a familiar world around us. We like that feeling of comfort. And so obviously the things that we've known in the past feel right and natural, quote unquote. But many of the things that we feel are not natural at all. So corn is a great example. You know, 12,000 years ago, go back in your time machine, try to find corn. you won't find anything like it. You'll just find a little weed with a few kernels. But over thousands of years of human genetic manipulation through selective breeding, we, our ancestors, turned that weed into what we know as corn today. And yet still, not everybody knows that story. But two, people feel like, oh, I only want organic, non-GMO corn. To manipulate corn, that's a violation of nature. And yet the thing that they're calling nature isn't natural at all. I'm a skier, and I love skiing in the mountains in Colorado. I love spending time in the forest. And the reason why I can enjoy all of that, and our ancestors who were in those kinds of places were actually terrified because there were all kinds of predators that were killing them and life was harsh, is that we have defeated those environments and we have remapped them in our own image so much that now they feel comfortable and natural to us, even though they're not natural at all. Or people's dogs. I mean, what is a dog? But tens of thousands of years of human selective breeding of a wolf. So when you take a wolf and you wind up with a chihuahua, is that natural? So I just feel like we humans are in the business of manipulating nature. And the reason that we do it, because nature, as it found us, was trying to kill us. And that's why we developed agriculture. That's why we developed medicine. And so I get that we're talking here about the future of life. And I certainly believe we need to be humble and we need to be careful and we need to make sure that we have an ethical and a legal and regulatory framework surrounding our actions. But this gut feeling, oh, that's not natural, I find is often uninformed.
So how do you see this technology informing our political debates? Obviously, every election cycle, abortion is a hot button issue. I can imagine that we're in for an even more incendiary political debate when this hits the market.
Yeah, well, certainly this technology will become a massive political issue sooner rather than later. One of the reasons why I've written the book is I feel that if and when this does, we need to have a basic level of common understanding of what is at play. And so I've written Hacking Darwin to be an accessible book that anybody, even people with no science background, can pick up and say, wow, now I understand what it is. I understand what's at stake. I understand my responsibilities. And then we can have an informed conversation. And in that conversation, we need to have everybody represented, not just the people who are like me, who are very comfortable with revolutionary science, but a lot of people who are afraid, a lot of people who come from religious backgrounds. And all of those people need to be welcome in a big national and global conversation that can inform our politics. Because if the politics is just based on people's fears and gut feelings, that won't be as constructive of a conversation as if it's based on people who are really kind of thinking through and are educated on the issues. And to be educated and thinking it through doesn't mean that everyone will agree with me, but it means that they will have the tools to be part of the conversation. So if all of the future of assisted reproduction and genetic technologies gets woven into the abortion debate, that's a really dangerous place. But I think a healthier way of thinking about this will be that there is a natural transition. And so healthcare will be the first application. And we're going to move from our generalized system of healthcare to precision healthcare based on each person's own individualized biology. And what that will mean is that everyone will have their sequence genome and other biometric information as the foundation of their electronic health records. And through that process, by comparing the sequence genome to people's other aspects of people's health and life records, we're going to know more and more about what genes do. But then things are going to get, as I've already described, more complicated. And we're going to need to have regulation. We're going to need to have public engagement and public debate. And that's very healthy and very normal. I'm just last night came back from England, and I was meeting there with the head of the UK Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, And the UK has done a great job of educating their public. They've had many, many years of national debates and conversations and public forums on issues like mitochondrial transfer. They have a very well thought out regulatory structure. And so in every country is going to, they're way ahead of the United States in that process. And every country is going to need to have that kind of legal and regulatory infrastructure, because if this just becomes a no holds barred fight between, like the GMO issue is, you know, between the people who are comfortable with it and the people who have a gut feeling it's bad, in many cases without a lot of information, then that is going to be a much worse starting point than a more reasoned and informed conversation leading to norms, leading to laws, leading to regulations.
I'm glad you brought up the GMO controversy, because consumers today are still, not everybody, but many consumers are still concerned about crop biotechnology. I mean, the thought of modifying the genes of vegetables, still really scary to people. So how do you see that controversy translating into this topic that we're talking about?
There are a lot of fears around genetically modified crops. As a matter of fact, the fears are so great, and some of them are unfounded and some of them are founded, but they're so great and they're so powerful that in many parts of Europe, not only have opted out of the benefits of the GMO revolution, but they've also established barriers that are so strong that you know, people in the developing world, particularly Africa and South Asia, are actually massively harmed because they aren't able to produce crops that domestically using genetic technologies that could actually help them do things like respond to the changing climate as a result of climate change. And the reason that they can't do that is because of European import restrictions. And so, yeah, and GMO is in my mind, it's a great example of what not to do. And the scientists, and that in the early days, it was called recombinant DNA, they actually did a fantastic job of understanding what the science was, what its implications were, and then meeting together to establish guidelines for how it could be safely used, which have largely held. But because the public wasn't sufficiently part of that conversation, people had this gut feeling that GMOs were some kind of big corporate plot to take over the world. And that's why even today, even with pretty much all of the science Nobel laureates alive, have signed petitions saying, you know, that there's nothing inherently unsafe about GM crops. And as a matter of fact, we need to use some of them to actually fight terrible diseases and save lives. Even in spite of that, there's still this gut feeling that they are wrong. And I'm not saying that everything about GM crops is great. I mean, there are legitimate concerns about things like monoculture, but there's absolutely no evidence that genetically modified crops are bad, unhealthy for people to consume. But if you polled people, as a matter of fact, a recent poll showed that the people who are the most adamantly anti-GMO are, in fact, the least educated about what GMOs are. And there's a real danger of people just kind of having a gut feeling that something is bad. And I think that doesn't mean that everything needs to be good or that people can't be educated and then still feel that something is bad. But we should try to start with educating people. And I think there's a counterexample to the genetically modified crops example, and that's IVF, which very quickly, although when IVF was developed, the first IVF baby was born 40 years ago, there was this outrage and that this is really bad. But very quickly, it normalized because people saw the benefits. I mean, people saw parents having children who otherwise wouldn't. And it's normalized in a way that genetically modified crops haven't, even though IVF is not quote unquote natural, just like, according to some people, just like genetic modification is not quote unquote natural according to others. So there's different scenarios and there are different warning signs. And we need to try to make sure that this technology, as intimate as it will feel to people, plays out in a more open, inclusive, and informed context.
On a related note, you say that this technology, if it's misused, could create oppressive hierarchies, spark international conflict, and lead us to commodify human life. And I mean, that really scares most people. I think that's the worst case scenario. People start envisioning super soldiers and designer babies. It sounds like something almost out of like an alternative history of Nazi Germany. How likely are these worst case scenarios?
You know, they're possible. And I think that when we, I have a PhD in history. And so when we look back at history, when people have had certain real or perceived advantages, they've often leveraged them to oppress others. And you look at the history of European colonialism, that Europeans had a relatively small advantage in weapons and ships and science and technology, and used that to conquer and oppress most of the rest of the world. So is it possible that these genetic technologies could be connected to some kind of dangerous ideology? Absolutely. I mean, Nazism itself was in some ways an outgrowth of Darwinism. And so it's possible. Whether it's hard to put a percentage likelihood, I would say it's more likely than not that it won't happen. But I think that if we're not mindful of the worst case scenarios, we won't be having the right conversation. So we need to recognize that these technologies, like all technologies, can be abused. And so there's nuclear weapons and nuclear power. There's AI and autonomous killer robots. And so every technology has its potential dark side. And being aware of what that is and planning to optimize the good and minimize the bad is the name of the game for what we need to do now.
So one thing I want to stress is that you say this technology is coming, and throughout the book, you use 2045 as sort of a future starting point. So are we at a place where we either stick our heads in the sand or we have a conversation about this?
Absolutely. It's coming whatever we do. What we can do, though, is guide how it plays out. And that's why the ethical conversation is so important.
Yeah, well, I am very curious to see how this plays out. And related and a final question, you make the point that storytelling is an effective way to communicate technical science to average people like me. I'm wondering, is storytelling the bridge that academics like you are going to use to communicate with the general public as this technology comes to fruition?
I can't speak for other people, but I can certainly say for me. I mean, my first book was a history, a very dense history of the Cambodian genocide, which was a revision of my PhD dissertation. And then my second book, though, was a novel telling the story of the Cambodian genocide, but in the context of characters and a plot. And I was able, I hope, to have people learn about this very difficult subject, but learn it is part of a story, because that's how we tend to learn on a popular level as a species. And so certainly, I'm also, as you know, a science fiction writer. And so actually the genesis of this book was I was on my book tours for my novels, but when I explained the science to people the way a novelist would explain science, which is different in many cases from the way a scientist would explain science, all of a sudden I could see people's eyes going wide. They got it. They got what I was trying to say. And so what I've tried to do is use the telling of stories and use voice and an accessible style to bring people into the conversation. Because if this is just a conversation among experts, like it was with the GMO crops, and like it's been to date on the issues of genetic engineering, then that is going to be not optimal. So we have to tell stories. We have to reach people where they are, not where we may like them to be. And that's what I'm trying to do.
All right. Well, I hope everyone goes out and reads Hacking Darwin. It's been a fascinating read. I'm taking all kinds of notes in the margins of this book as I think of things. Where can people get the book?
It's out April 23rd of 2019, and you can get it anywhere you get books. So, obviously, so Amazon, Barnes & Noble, local bookstore, really anywhere you go, you'll be able to get it. order it, and I hope everybody will enjoy it. And if anybody wants to contact me with any questions, they can also feel free to go to my website, which is www.jamiemetzl.com.
All right, guys, that's going to do it for us today. Thank you so much for joining in. The podcast is officially on iTunes. You can also get it at geneticliteracyproject.org. It's the Biotech Facts and Fallacies podcast on the homepage. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next time.